This is Red, Chapter 3, Seasons. It was as Jim said. Every season of life on Red came with work. Grain had been stored. Half of the vegetable garden was harvested and canned. The rest would wait for winter. In the few days since Spock's laboratory was set up, Jim could spend an hour or less watching Spock set up. He never asked questions, but Spock took it upon himself to narrate aloud what he was doing, and Jim listened with rapt interest and desisted every time Spock asked. It was unusual, but Jim was unusual. He was also notably intelligent, although denied any previous teacher thought so. It was obvious that he had some engineering training on Tarsus or his life before the doomed colony. Spock had never had to repeat an instruction, and the human could infer next steps without assistance. He could be an excellent assistant, if only Dr. McCoy wasn't opposed to Jim spending even more time with Spock. However, once the preparation for the festival started, there was no time for anything else. Jim and Spock moved 20 backless benches into the space between the mission house and the barn. 3 fire pits were made ready, 1 large one and 2 smaller ones, out in the fields. Jim pointed out where tents would be pitched, because the festivity stretched overnight as well. Barrels of potable water were gathered, tables were set up, all the linens washed and hung to dry. Occasionally, neighbors would come with pie and grains, bushels of corn and game they hunted, dressed and ready to be roasted.
"Just when you think you have enough food, they'll be bringing 3 times as much, and it's all gone by sunrise," Bones explained as Spock single-handedly moved a giant cauldron to the main fire.
The morning of the festival, McCoy was walking around better than he had been, now wearing a lighter cast and walking without the wooden crutch. He found Spock and Jim finishing with the animals while it was still cool.
"Best get ready," McCoy advised. "The hordes descend in less than an hour. How's our bluebell?"
"Ornery," Jim reported, slowly making his way to the fence where McCoy stood.
"She'll have her kids when she's good and ready, which will be the most inconvenient time ever, I'm sure."
As if offended, Bluebell took that moment to bound around the paddock, knocking into Jim and sending him sliding into a patch of mud. Jim groaned, rolling over and picking himself up.
"She told you, and now you stink," McCoy said ungenerously. "Go shower in the bunkhouse. I'll get first meal ready."
Jim shrugged, tugging at his filthy shirt.
"Yeah. Spock, my clothes are laid out on my bed. Would you mind fetching them?"
Spock nodded and followed the doctor to the mission house.
"First door up the stairs," McCoy directed, fidgeting with the red rock stove.
Spock walked up the stairs and opened the first door, creaking loudly in the near silence. Jim had a sparsely appointed room, whitewashed board walls and puncheon floors, with a single narrow bed with a red woolen blanket. There were no pictures or personal items, save his toiletries lined neatly on top of a chest of drawers. On the bed lay a pair of navy trousers and a recently pressed blue shirt, obviously laid out in preparation for the festival. Spock noticed that Jim would need socks and the shoes he wore in the evenings. The brown shoes were easily found at the foot of the bed, but Spock had to go rummaging through the chest of drawers to find socks. What he found instead was bundles of wires. Wires and capacitors and what looked like part of a phase coil resonator. It was a hodgepodge of equipment, too old to have come from Spock's laboratory. He traced the edge of a hyperspanner and then gently closed the drawer, finding what he needed in the next one.
"Find everything?" McCoy asked, hovering over a griddle of pancakes.
"Yes," Spock said, making a beeline back to the bunkhouse. When he reached the bunkhouse, he could hear Jim in the lean-to, wringing out his dirty clothes and whistling an unfamiliar tune. Spock unnecessarily cleared his throat.
"Your clothes?"
"Thanks, teacher." Jim extended his hand through the crack in the door, exposing an arm and shoulder, pale and well-muscled, more skin than any Azanite would show. Spock handed him the clothes and waited for Jim to dress in the modesty of the lean-to. When Jim stepped out, Spock was forced to quietly admit his gaze lingered a moment longer than necessary on his young host.
"I know, I don't often wear my Sunday best," Jim said shyly, the old colloquialism lost on Spock. "But today is special."
In respect for his host traditions, Spock wore his officer grays, which regulation dictated were to only be worn at significant events of hosting cultures. Jim was silent a moment, and then asked questions about the pips at his collar, but didn't mention the drawer. McCoy rolled his eyes when they arrived at the table.
"At ease, Lieutenant," he drawled.
Spock had come to learn this was what McCoy did when he was amused. As predicted, as soon as the first meal dishes were washed and dried, families started to pour in, all carrying tent poles and pies, tools and canned goods. Babies were swaddled between skeins of wool and cans of soup. Dozens of children started to fill the yard carrying sacks of grain or sticks, shrieking and laughing, and filling the typically quiet mission with more noise and life than Spock thought possible. Jim and McCoy were swept away by the crowd within minutes, needing to tend or direct one thing or another, and Spock felt adrift as clusters of people ambled up the drive to the mission house. He understood and tolerated the curious stares, expected the whispers, but did not anticipate feeling so alone in a sea of people. It was similar to his first day at Starfleet Academy. Half an hour later, McCoy grabbed Spock by the arm and deftly maneuvered him to where a small group of elders sat, each in the three backed chairs that typically sat at the mission table, now arranged at the best spot by the communal fire, like thrones.
"This is Teacher, Lieutenant Spock," the doctor announced. They nodded in acknowledgement. The eldest, an Andorian with her white hair braided in intricate patterns around her antennae, gestured for him to come closer until she could peer directly into his face.
"A Vulcan," she declared in a weak, warbling voice. "We've never had a Vulcan join us before."
"They'd rather think in circles and call it productive," the other woman beside her snarked, dusting non-existent lint off her plain green jumpsuit. The man, dressed in red woven suspenders and a wide-collared white shirt, made no comment.
"Spock has lifted a great weight off my shoulders and bore it like no visitor has," McCoy said generously. "No worse time to have broken my tibia, but Starfleet sent Teacher to us early."
"Good fortune," the Andorian woman said, patting Spock's arm absently.
"I imagine you'll be getting more permanent help around here soon, Leonard."
McCoy glanced at Spock briefly, and then away, frowning.
"Not this season, I think, Beta."
"Your young charge has no plans for a helpmate?"
Beta asked, blinking owlishly.
"He's focused on the mission, and too young to settle just yet."
McCoy's mouth set in a stubborn mien.
"I was 2 years younger when I pledged my troth."
"Good comes in its own time. Folly is rushed,"
McCoy recited.
"Jim will have his own time.
I won't stand for anyone trying to lure him out the door prematurely."
"Next year, perhaps,"
Beta mused.
"It would be nice to have some little ones running around here again, eh, Leonard?"
"In its own time,"
McCoy echoed, smiling a little wistfully.
"Do you think it will be a busy festival, Leonard?"
the elder man asked. McCoy shrugged, looking over the assembled crowd, already over 200 people, milling about and visiting in groups.
"I suspect the Rollins will be by soon. David and Khadija have been sitting together in the last meeting."
"My Annalise's youngest daughter and the Chi girl have been courting," the woman in green added. "I'm sure you'll be hearing from them soon."
The conversation went like this for a few minutes more. Updates and gossip. Spock got to see McCoy as he had never seen him before,
an unofficial leader of sorts. After the death of Enid Winter Perez, an informal council formed, but McCoy's role was undefined. It seemed, as the day wore on, McCoy wore the hat of doctor, arbitrator, and justice of the peace. Before a second meal, he had fielded a negotiation of resources between three neighbors, settled a dispute between two brothers, and agreed to officiate two marriages. "Is it often like this?" Spock asked when the crowd around McCoy had finally dispersed.
"No, it's usually worse," the doctor groused. "Everyone has their role in this dance. We take it up joyfully."
"Oh, good. Second meal."
Someone had rung the dinner bell, a large gong on the side of the mission porch that had been unused until today. As if the seas had been parted, some members of the family started to make their way to the large tables and sit, while others stood back. McCoy grabbed Spock's arm again and escorted him to the table.
"Guests sit first," McCoy explained, "and the elders. Everyone gets a turn, the kids eat last, and I will know if anyone disturbs the natural order, because that entire brickle cobbler has my name on it," raising his voice at the end, making several of the children behind him giggle.
Spock sat on one of the long benches, thankfully at a corner, where he only had the doctor at one shoulder. At least 5 dozen fit at the first table, dressed in pressed shirts, cotton jumpsuits, gingham dresses, straw hats, and braids. Another table sat parallel, and beyond that was the barn, where Jim leaned against a fence with a few other youths. He caught Spock's eye and gave a wave.
"Dear friends," a strong voice carried out, the woman in green, "we gather joyfully."
We gather joyfully,
the crowd echoed. "To plant, to harvest, to share, and now to join again."
"Good fortune,"
they answered back. "And good fortune to you. Bountiful harvest, health, and season renewed."
The standing Azonites immediately gathered platters and pitchers and began serving the people seated. Before he could object, Spock's plate was piled with roasted potatoes, squash, beans, and yeasty bread, more than he would typically serve himself.
"Casserole, teacher," each one would offer, serve him before he could answer, and left before he could understand what was piled onto his plate.
Jim walked among the other men and women, moving slowly to greet and chat with the other Azonites seated. By the time he reached Spock, his plate was only half cleared.
"There's no third meal during festival," Jim warned him. "Nothing but roasted corn, and whatever leftovers you can sneak out of the camp kitchen. So you better eat now."
"I think I will be sated," Spock said, but Jim deftly spooned chestnut stuffing onto his plate. "For several days, at least."
Jim grinned without comment and moved on to the next person. The buzz around the table continued as they left their seats for the next groups, younger and younger, until the youngest children sat. Spock watched with interest as he surveyed the school-aged children, at least 80 of them, eating the last of the feast. "Most of them don't come to school. They get their reading and arithmetic lessons at home," Jim said, taking a seat on the fence at his elbow.
"Is it sufficient?"
Jim shrugged. "They seem to think so. You don't need quantum physics to plant a crop or raise a barn. Less than a dozen families want their kids trained in the classics." "I received the approved curriculum."
"What did you think?"
"Very Terran-centric," Spock admitted. His companion nodded. "Created by the second teacher we had. A little xenophobic.
Looking back on it, I think she imagined Red would be some sort of pre-contact paradise. She didn't last long, but her legacy remains. Every single one of the Bard's works, even the sonnets, all year long, every teacher, for the last 6 years. Dunn was too risque. Rowling was too fantastical."
"I appreciate most of Shakespeare's works," Spock admitted to Jim's surprise.
My mother had an extensive library of human literature. However, I have received permission to update some of the texts. Jim nodded knowingly. It was a big topic of conversation at the last meeting. Can we acknowledge the invention of the replicator and include Tellarite epic prose, or should we ease into it? I was gratified the elders agreed with my pedagogical rationale. They didn't, Jim said cheekily, but Bones tired them out. Before Spock could request Jim to explain, two youths came skipping up to the fence where Jim sat, tugging on his arms. Jim! One exclaimed breathlessly, tucking her curly dark hair behind her ear. We're picking teams. You'll be on ours? Jim glanced over at Spock, helpless and regretful.
We need you, the shorter wheedled. You're the oldest and the strongest, and you need to balance the other teams out. Please, Jim.
Jim sighed. Sure. The girl started to giggle and skipped away. Jim sighed, standing up. Don't judge me too harshly, Jim warned. For what, precisely? For what I'm about to do next.
End of chapter 3. Author's notes. This will be fun, I said. Only a few thousand words, I said. Lies, gentle readers, all lies. I'd rather share this bit of the chapter now, knowing that it's true, what McCoy says. Good comes in its own time. I can't find it within myself to rush pastoral space romance. I don't think this will be an epically slow burn, but I hope you feel like sticking with me. Haystack's next chapter. Promise. This is Read by Walk and Talk. Chapter 4. Together.
Ah, Dr. McCoy hummed, joining Spock and a growing group of lookers-on the side of the recently plowed field. The traditional Azanite mating display. The dry comment earned a few huffs of embarrassed laughter from the small crowd. Academically, it made sense. Most cultures used feats of skill and strength as part of their mating rituals. In this harsh environment, one would want a partner that had dexterity, strength, and cunning. He watched as Jim hoisted a log 4 times his height and sent it flying across the field, impressed by the strength wound in his lean arms and shoulders.
It's called caber toss, McCoy said over the cheers and hoots of the teams and audience. Some of the families brought it from Earth, Scotland. They'll do some races, wrestling, red boar tipping, and the like, until they've worn themselves out and declare a champion. It's tradition that the unmarried folks participate.
You are not married, Spock commented.
I am, technically, McCoy said in a clipped tone that invited no further comment. There were several rounds of log throwing. Jim only bested by one other participant, making his team groan in disappointment.
Races, announced one of the girls who begged Jim into the games. We're still uneven.
I can sit out, Jim immediately offered, making several on his team object. The pause in the games made the growing audience restless.
You aren't married, McCoy shot back to Spock, clamping a startlingly strong hand on his shoulder, propelling him forward. Teacher can.
The group of assembled young people turned, surprised. From the back, Spock could make out Jim's inviting grin.
Teacher?
The girl with the dark curly hair asked, shock written on her face. Spock shot a sidelong glance at McCoy. I was not planning on participating in all the local traditions, he said, gesturing to his dress uniform.
Come on, teacher, Jim called out. We promised to take it easy on you.
Spock did not splutter, but he did start to unbutton his dress coat, gratified he had undergarments suitable for athletic participation, to the titters of the adolescents. As he walked out where the small line was forming, a few of the bystanders started to clap. Over here, teacher, one said, an Orion girl with her hair bound in wide braids. Hope you're fast.
I possess significantly more muscle mass than a typical human.
Yeah, the young woman grinned. But can you run?
Why do you ask?
'Cause you've got to outrun Jim.
When the whip cracked, it became apparent why that was the only strategy given. Jim took a quick and startling lead within a few seconds. He was agile, comfortable in bare feet on the strangely soft terrain of Red. Spock found it easy to catch up, but not without surprising strain. It wasn't until the third bend in their informal track that Spock was able to overtake the other man, and only then by a few arm lengths. Spock's newly adopted team cheered, although a little too shy to thump him on the back. But that didn't stop Jim, breathless and rosy, from bracing his arms on Spock's.
"You got me," he declared. "You've ended my 4-year winning streak."
The girl who warned Spock of Jim's speed ran up, beaming.
"Teacher, you've got to stay on our team," she gushed, almost bouncing out of her boots.
Jim caught Spock's eye and inferred Spock's discomfort with the idea.
"Nah, not this round, Gayla. Teacher and I will sit this one out."
The young woman paused, treating Spock with a long, speculative look.
"Save me a dance, Jim."
She turned on her heel, leaving them to walk back to where the bulk of the merrymakers were. McCoy handed them cups of water, which they gratefully took, Jim downing his in one go. Someone passed a flagon around to refill cups, and Jim snagged it as it went through the crowd.
"Red grain?
It's tradition." Spock nodded, noting that McCoy became eerily quiet at his elbow as he watched Spock offer Jim his cup to fill and take a sip. The drink was a bitter fermented alcohol, not dissimilar to scotch mixed with coffee grounds.
"Interesting," Spock commented, making McCoy snort.
"It's not tradition, Jim, it's torture," McCoy complained. Jim shrugged.
"Not like I'd know any better. Tastes normal to me."
"Bones says it tastes like red." "The bitterness derived from carnalite and shale," Spock deduced, now more interested in the drink.
"I can show you how, if you like," Jim offered.
McCoy gestured them toward the barn as his attention was drawn toward a conversation about next season's trading day. Jim led him back to the lee side of the barn, where the food had been long cleared away, and now many adults were hunched over tables, talking excitedly. Several barrels were out, and cups for the potable water. He pointed out the makeshift distillery, making red grain fast and dirty. No need for a long fermentation period if you get some of it set up beforehand.
"I think it's the grain's properties," Jim explained.
Spock asked a few more questions, resolved to investigate more of the flora when time allowed. Several people were passing flagons and pitchers around, while the smallest children were bounced on knees and kept busy with wooden toys, their older siblings running between the games in the fields and up to the fires to beg some cake or roasted nuts from whoever was tending them at that moment. A few of the younglings had taken a dowel rod and a homemade beanbag to play some facsimile of the Terran game, cricket.
"Do you play?"
Jim asked, gesturing to a group hovering over cards. Spock shook his head.
"I'm unfamiliar with these games."
"We play Catiscot and Rummy sometimes," Jim said, walking through the groups until they found Ben and his husband Hikaru sitting at another table with two other players. "Gayla taught me Ikrit, and Hikaru is the colony's chess champion."
"Chess, yes,"
Hikaru agreed, deftly moving a rook. "But don't let him pretend he hasn't beaten me across this board more than a few times."
"You want to play winner?"
"Not me."
"Teacher."
Spock politely declined, content to sit and watch the game. Several others walked by, offering slightly warmer greetings to Spock as the day progressed. At one point, Jim abandoned him for some reason, and Ben managed to entice him into a conversation about the geology of the plot of land he and Hikaru were considering to raise their red boars. The afternoon passed, and second sun started its hours-long descent, casting the sky into lilac and gold. Spock assisted Jim and the others in setting out roasted corn into the large communal fire for simple meals, and more flagons of red grain came out of the never-ending rapid distillery, and McCoy eventually made his way back, Jim giving up his seat at Spock's side immediately.
Several people brought instruments out, small woodwinds and string instruments. One had a drum the size of a wagon wheel, and the musicians began to play a long, low note, casting a hush upon the crowd. McCoy and Jim immediately perked up, watching as the four elders Spock had met that morning stood, and the crowd gathered around them.
"We gather joyfully,"
Beta, the eldest Andorian, called. We gather joyfully, the crowd of 400 called back, a bit more enthusiastically after hours of celebration and games.
"There is no greater joy than to give what one has,"
she recited to the enthusiastic murmurs of the crowd.
"The gift of life, the gift of time, of work, the gift of love. Who among us is prepared to give such a gift today?"
The crowd seemed to hold its breath, and Spock's head swiveled when two people moved to the center, and then another couple. They were all blushing, each holding hands and grinning, to the applause and whistles of their friends and family.
"You come before your community today to take a partner, your life's helpmate. Who here shares an objection?"
A perfunctory silence followed, and Beta continued.
"So be it."
Beta reached into her pocket and withdrew two small stones, handing one to each couple, who then clasped hands around it.
"This is the weight of the burdens and joys you bear, and together you will carry."
She withdrew several strips of cloth, holding them out to the other elders, who began to wind and braid the colors around the couple's clasped hands and forearms.
"These are the ties of marriage, family, and community. They will support you together all your days. As you cannot drop the stone, you cannot forsake each other, nor your community, nor the work you share, without rejecting the most fundamental bonds that brought you here today. Do you accept these bonds, and pledge to honor your helpmate in all things?"
"We do.
We do.
We do."
"Then it is done. For all of eternity, good fortune on all your days,"
Beta called, and the couples unwound themselves, still grinning.
Good fortune,
the group called back. Spock had attended only one Terran wedding ceremony, on the first vessel he had ever served on, and was a little surprised the ceremony was not sealed with the traditional human kiss. The group still cheered and hooted for the four newlyweds, and the musicians started up again with a jaunty tune, calling several couples and groups to the unofficial floor. People milled about, sharing their blessings and felicitations to the two new couples, and watching the folk dancing.
"Do you dance, teacher?"
one of the men asked. Spock noticed several heads swiveled in his direction, Jim's included.
"No, I do not," he admitted. "Vulcans do not dance, as I remember,"
McCoy added. "Not traditionally, no," Spock agreed.
"Although I was trained in the Vulcan lyre."
Jim perked up. "I didn't know you could play music."
"You've been holding out on us, teacher," McCoy said.
Spock was about to agree when the man who asked him about dancing held out his hand to Jim. Jim looked over at McCoy, who nodded indulgently, and Jim took off to join the other couples and groups in an athletic-looking reel.
"The dancing is the only thing that isn't part of formal courting," McCoy explained idly. "Gives them a chance to mix under our eyes."
He leaned in closer. "As teacher, you'll have to keep a sharp gaze, you understand." Spock nodded wordlessly, following Jim as he stepped and turned adeptly through the crowd with his new partner. The evening continued like that through three songs, as Jim changed partners and then made his way back to the benches where Spock and McCoy stood.
"Does anyone want to steal some butter cake before it's gone?"
McCoy shook his head, waving his cup of some unidentifiable liquid, but Spock stood, suddenly weary of the crowds and looking forward to being anywhere quieter. Jim led him back into the mission house, where it was almost deserted, except for a few younglings darting out the door, carrying butter cake and berries in their fists.
The best part of being one of the mission's orphans was festival, Jim confided. We were the only ones who knew where the last buttercake was hidden. He opened a tall cabinet and revealed an untouched pan and cut out two large slices. It was the first time Jim spoke openly about how he arrived on Red. Was it difficult when you first came? He asked, accepting the cake, still sticky from the honey brought that morning. No. Jim smiled sadly. You know, before. Spock nodded. After, this was the closest to safety I could think of as a kid. Bones was the first adult who ever made it known my safety and security was his priority, and followed through with it. It's harder when you mature, I think. You know more about what you want, even if you don't know it's possible. Spock wanted to voice his question, the one he thought since he witnessed Jim's eyeing the science equipment in the bunkhouse.
Would you leave Red to find it?
They left the mission house out the back door, twilight rapidly falling, and several fires casting unusual shadows upon the sparse buildings. Spock ate the entire slice of buttercake, surprising himself, and finding that he could not, in fact, process red honey any better than Terran honey. Jim would perhaps call him tipsy, if he wasn't also a bit himself. They walked along the low path around back. The sounds of the crowd thankfully dampened, but Jim swung away from the empty fields and back towards the crowd. Spock could make out the faintest of giggle and whispers in the distance. Jim chuckled at Spock's expression. I wouldn't go back there unless you wanted to see something you'd have to report before school even started, he said wryly. They think they're being sneaky, but everyone knows it's a harvest tradition to get your first kiss behind the mission haystacks. Did you? Spock asked before he could stop himself. Jim's mouth popped open and then snapped shut. Even in the moonlight, Spock could see Jim's cheeks go pink. No, nothing like that. Spock could palpably feel the awkward silence descend, regretting his forward decision. Mine was at a Starfleet ball. Huh? I was escorting Yoda Uhura at a Starfleet formal function, and I had misunderstood her romantic overture. I thought she was whispering something. I was mistaken, and she kissed me. I thought it was an accident. Jim chuckled, which gratified Spock. Doesn't sound romantic. I have since ascertained the pleasure comes from the reciprocated meaning of the exchange. Jim snorted again, tension diffused. I guess so. Jim. The man paused, his face shadowed in the moonlight, and Spock strained to see his expression. Yes? I would like to kiss you. Spock held his breath, sure that Jim was doing the same. The human's hand twitched, as if about to reach out, and then went still. I can't, Jim sighed. It's not that... I just can't. Spock nodded, a small pang of regret. I understand. You do not need to explain. I will not speak of it again. No, I mean... Jim's shoulders hunched, and he swayed on his feet. You could talk to Bones... if you wanted. Dr. McCoy. Yes, talk to him, and maybe we could sit together at dinner. Spock paused, trying to decipher the string of sounds that spilled out of Jim's mouth. We sit together at dinner every night, he pointed out, not comprehending Jim's meaning. But it would be different if you asked him. Spock puzzled on what he said, still not understanding, and said so. Jim, McCoy's voice called out from the mission house. I have to go, Jim whispered. Think about it. That was all Spock had time to do. Think about Jim. Jim and his brilliant mind, his unlikely situation, his more impossible customs. He returned to his bunkhouse alone, listening to the sounds of the lute, drums, and laughter muffled by the barn, the vegetable garden, and several haystacks that secreted lovers from watchful eyes. When the answer finally revealed itself, Spock felt more foolish than when Yoda Uhura pecked him on the lips at the Academy ball. Jim wanted to be courted.
End of chapter 4. Author's notes. Dear gentle readers, I hope you enjoyed this chapter. Personal fact, the hand fasting ceremony is based loosely on my own wedding, and I look at our cords every time I sit down to write. Next chapter, Spock sits down with Bones for a real heart-to-heart. Or something.